You're listening to A Conduit's Diary. This is a podcast about me, Rachel, and my experiences as I investigate paranormal activity as a conduit. This is rated R for explicit because I do have a little bit of a foul mouth. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe and rate this podcast wherever you listen to it. Let's get to it. Episode 35, Don't Blame the Harbinger. Katrina was nervous. Her hands were folded in her lap, but she was picking a hole in the already abused skin of her thumb. It looked like a nervous tick more than a conscious movement, her nails digging rhythmically into the tissue. Despite the fact that I'd been in her house for nearly 20 minutes, she hadn't really said much. "Do you want a water?" I asked. I'm not sure why I was offering her a water in her own home, but it seemed like the only way to calm her nerves. She shook her head in a quick gesture, unclasping her hands and repositioning them to continue her assault on the opposite thumb. I cleared my throat and shifted uncomfortably in my seat. Katrina didn't live in the usual home that I visit. The current trend of home decor in the valley was bright white walls with black everything else. Katrina's home was nothing like this. It was hidden in the end of a cul-de-sac in the far southern reaches of Chandler, right up against the lines of the reservation. From the outside, it looked inconspicuous. The same rock and cacti front yard as everyone else, the exterior made up with the same faux stones as every other home in the neighborhood. Two houses down, a teenage boy was throwing a basketball into a hoop on the driveway, despite the visible heat rising in waves off the pavement. Still, there was an air of something off about her house. I noticed it when I parked in the street and saw that all the windows were dark. That itself wasn't too unusual. During the summer, most Arizona residents really tamp down on their electric bills by blocking out every heat and light source possible. I'm not sure why it sent a shiver down my spine to see the windows so dark, but it did. I've learned over the years not to discredit the chill that races down your spine, even when you can't put a finger on it. Katrina let me in before I even knocked. She'd probably been watching me from one of the cameras perched not so secretly over her garage and her front porch. I tried to write it off as hypervigilance against Amazon porch thieves, but the more time I spent watching Katrina worry, the more I worried that she was just paranoid. "Listen, if you want me to leave, I can come back later. If you're not ready, it's fine," I told her. I'd tried a few times to start the conversation in my usual way. "What's going on? How long? What's the beginning?" She would just flatten her lips against each other and gaze over my head at something I couldn't see. I was starting to realize the ominous vibe was about her, which made the entire situation even more eerie and awkward. "Okay then," I said, as I started to stand. I was turning my back to her when she spoke at last, her voice hollow and quiet. "The first time I ever went to New York City was September 10th, 2001. I paused and turned slowly, settling back into the chair. Her eyes were fixed on me now, deep amber eyes that looked far older than she did. If she remembered her visit, then she couldn't be much different in age than me. I was in 7th grade on September 11th. I remember turning on MTV while making myself cereal, as I always did, watching the news scroll endlessly across the screen. I remember frowning and changing to VH1, to Fuse, to any other music channel. The same screen played on every single channel. Planes. Explosions. Terrorism. I'd never even heard of the World Trade Center. I knew nothing about what was going on. It wasn't until I made it to band class, when my band teacher broke down in sobs in front of all of us, that I realized that something terrible had happened. I had this pull to go. I'd been bothering my mom for weeks, months even. I couldn't even explain what I wanted to see so badly. I didn't like plays, so it's not like it was about Broadway. I'd never been on a plane before. I was like 10, 11 years old. All I knew is I wanted to go, and we had to go that day. My mom bought the tickets, and my family flew to New York City. The next day, the planes hit, and we watched the whole thing from our hotel. I shivered, feeling a light sheen of sweat on my skin. "It wasn't just that," she continued, her eyes unblinking as they fastened on me. "It was the men. I saw them in the streets when we explored the city the day before. No, maybe that's not true. Maybe I hadn't noticed them then. They would have blended in, wouldn't they have? Men in business suits with briefcases. That's everyone in New York City. Faceless, but in a literal sense. I've seen them since. I see them all the time." "Faceless men?" I managed. She nodded. "There's nothing there. Sometimes they wear a hat, and it's hidden beneath their hat, but you get up close, you can see the smooth nothingness. There's the arch where the brow should be, a bump where the nose should be, but it's skin, it's just flesh, it's nothing. They watch you without eyes. You can always tell what they're looking at. When it's one or two, it's no big deal. Maybe a car crash or a heart attack. But when they flood the area..." She sighed and shook her head. "I don't think I understand. You see faceless men?" I asked. She waved her hand in a gesture that was both dismissive and annoyed. "Yes, but it's not just about seeing them. I summon them." Thoroughly confused, I decided to stay silent in hopes that she would clarify. Surely she didn't think she was making a lick of sense. But her gaze was stuck on mine in that impenetrable way, her brow furrowed, her eyes unblinking. I really just wanted her to blink. "How do you summon them?" I asked when it was clear she wasn't going to give any other information. "I have this need," she said, her hand going to her chest. "It's an impulse, a sudden thought. I must go here. I must do this. I must talk to this person. It starts off small, like a little nagging in the back of my mind. If I ignore it, I get headaches, my vision clouds, I can vomit. It literally takes over my whole life. I've had to completely change my plans for life because of it. I used to want to be a doctor. I was applying for medical school when it became abundantly clear that I could never have a stationary job. When the impulse hits, I have a very short time to act on it before I'm completely incapacitated." "So you have a feeling, and it spirals out of control until you..." "What exactly?" "Answer it. Sometimes it's small. I need groceries now, but not from my normal grocery store. I need it from the one across the street. I need to leave in exactly 2 minutes. If I ignore something like that, sometimes I'll pass out. If I answer it..." She trailed off, waving her hands again. "If I answer it, I get there first. I know where to go without understanding. I'll make my way to the dairy aisle and watch people come and go. The first faceless man usually appears a few minutes after me. If others will join, they come quickly. Sometimes it's just one, sometimes it's 3, 4, 10. It seems to be related to the seriousness of the situation, like a ratio. One faceless man is an inconvenience. 10 is a tragedy. Hundreds is a disaster. So I'll stand at the end of the dairy aisle and wait. The faceless men will be next to me or at the end of the aisle until an old man reaches out to grab his milk and falls dead on the spot with an aneurysm. The faceless men will watch as panic ensues. If it's just us, they'll turn to me and watch, waiting for me to bring attention to what happened. Sometimes I raise the alarm. Sometimes I don't need to. The man will die. I'll call the police. They'll cart him away. The faceless men will disappear into the crowds, and I wait for the next headache, the next inkling. The silence that filled the room was deafening. I'd never been in a home so quiet before. I couldn't even hear the hum of their air conditioning. No clock ticked, no pool pump buzzed, no dog or cat clacked up and down the hallway. Just utter silence. "So, I started, unable to find the words. What was she telling me? And why? This was so far out of my wheelhouse. "You don't believe me?" she asked, a single brow raising. I shook my head and put my hands up. Absolutely not what I said. I just... I'm not sure how to handle what you're saying. Are you trying to say that you get premonitions about disasters, and when you go those places, faceless men show up and watch something bad happen? No, she said, shaking her head. I'm saying that I summon them. I'm always there first. Sometimes they just be walking down the street like they're waiting for the next thing to happen, for me to direct them. They'll tip their hat to me, give their little wordless hellos. No one else can see them. I've looked at security cameras, and they're never on them. You should understand that, right? To be the only one to see what's right there. I did, but not in the way she did. Katrina, how often does this happen? I asked. She stretched her arms in front of her, her back popping as she did. She let out a contented sigh. It depends. Lately, there's been more disasters, like it's amping up. When I was 14, I decided I wanted to go to London. It's not that unusual. What kid doesn't like a little travel? My mother had never been, and she just divorced my father, and she was so ready for a big trip. It was July, and we landed and took the train into London, then went to the underground. I'd never ridden public transit before. They shut it all down when we were in New York, and Arizona doesn't have anything like that. We walked to the outside of the underground when I felt it, the end of that pull. It was so persistent, I didn't even realize it. I didn't realize my unsettled stomach on the plane was more than just plane food and nerves, that the humming in my head that told me to go someplace. We were just outside the station when I saw them. Hundreds of faceless men. They were staring at the station. I grabbed my mom's hand and told her to stop, to wait. I pointed out the men. She didn't see them. She told me to stop being ridiculous. We're going to miss our train. Then the bombs went off. The ground trembled. People screamed. The lights flickered. Bloodied bodies came out of the station. The faceless men were rocking on their heels, clutching their suitcases to their body. My mom was screaming and pulling me away, but the weight was lifted. I'd done my purpose. I'd brought the faceless men to their end destination. I caused it. Just hold on, I started to interrupt, realizing quickly what this woman actually was. You want to know where I've been these last few years? I've watched a volcano go off and kill countless people who didn't even know it was ready to erupt. I stood waiting to board a helicopter to fly over a tropical paradise as one careened into a cliff in the horizon. My plane was diverted away from an island that flooded after a tsunami destroyed it. I've been outside of shootings, massacres. I've seen the mundane to the catastrophic. I'm always the first. The faceless men are next, and death follows. That doesn't mean you've summoned it. How can you summon it when you have a pull? You said so yourself. Something compels you to it, and if you ignore it, you get sick. If you summoned it, you would have more control, more direction. She laughed to interrupt me. Control? Do you have control over what you do? She asked as she waved at me. Yes, I do, I said. She rolled her eyes. You have an illusion of control, just as we all do. We think that if we eat well, we won't get sick. If we put on our seatbelts, we'll be safe. If we only go places with little to no crime, we'll come out unscathed. It turns out you just need someone like me to cross your path. Don't be melodramatic, I scoffed, narrowing my eyes at her. Was she really so ridiculous that she thought she had some sort of power? You're a harbinger. You're harmless, I added. She started visibly as though I'd punched her. Harmless? You think it's harmless what I can do? She asked, her voice rising. She stood then, her hands clenched at her side in fist, her eyes burrowing down at me. I've seen things that would make you weep. I've stood by and watched entire civilizations collapse, families destroyed, priceless relics turned to dust. I've seen terrorism, disease, and the very depths of human fanaticism. Yes, but you didn't cause them, I pressed, standing to stare her down. She may have well been a head taller than me and way more muscular than I was, but she was still a human. Well, human enough. Her rage was palpable, and I half expected her to sprout horns or wings and turn on me like some great beast. Really, she was just a woman who'd misinterpreted the sight bestowed on her. Think this through, Katrina, I pressed. What happens if you ignore the sensations? If you vomit and pass out and can't go where you're drawn? You wake up hours later and you're fine? Her jaw set firmly in what could only be reluctant affirmation. That's what I thought. The disaster happens whether or not you're there. It's just easier on you to be there. You don't summon anything. You aren't creating anything. You're drawn to it. That's a very passive way to paint me, she growled. I shrugged. That's what you are, though. You're a moth, and disaster is flame. You're a harbinger. Those faceless men, they're drawn to it. Not you. You're part of this world and can interact with the disaster, but they cannot. They're just watching and trying to feed off its energy. They're like succubus, but instead of feeding off sexual desire, they feed off disaster. They love sorrow. They want you to find someone to see what's going on so they can revel in the aftermath. The more of them there are, the more energy there is for them to feed off of. Don't you see? Slowly, Katrina was unfurling. Her hands were first, slackened at her side. Her shoulders dipped, her jaw unclenched. It was like watching a thread unspool, slowly releasing all the tension from her piece by piece until she sunk back in the couch. Have you really lived all this time thinking you were causing these things? I asked. She buried her face in her hands, her dark hair cascading over them. I don't, she started between her fingers, her voice cracking. I don't know what I thought or where the thoughts came from. It's hard. It is, I agreed. She looked up at me and I caught the start of a sneer on her face. It's hard to see things no one else does, to know that there's a whole existence that can either help or hurt those around you. It's hard to feel helpless when you're outmatched, unsure if it's right or wrong to say something, to defend yourself or your friends. What have you done to save those around you? She bit back the sneer as the realization hit her face. I am alone. There's no one around me, she said. I nodded. Exactly. You're in the cell you've made all because you were born with something you didn't control and didn't understand. Have you ever mentioned it to anyone in your family? She shook her head quickly. Absolutely not. I was raised very Catholic. My parents divorcing nearly tore my family apart. I can't imagine if I ever told them about this. She waved her hands to emphasize her point. And you never see anything else when you're drawn to these places? I asked. She shook her head. No one else looks aware. It's just people going about their normal everyday lives, unaware that disaster's about to strike and me not knowing who it's going to affect. You couldn't warn them if you wanted to, I offered. But I could, she countered. You could warn the man in the dairy aisle he's about to die and he'll spend his last moments terrified. You'll call into an entire city and tell them you've had a premonition something bad's going to happen. And what? She shifted. Why did you call me here? I asked. Katrina frowned and looked up at the ceiling. I was raised Catholic. I suppose I wanted to confess. The implications of her word hit hard, and my heart wrenched in my chest. Where was the support group for people like me? For people like Hema and Katrina? She let out a bitter laugh and shook her head. Now I feel even more lost. I've been wrong about my whole life, and I've let it, God, the things I've done. The guilt I felt packing a bikini, knowing people will die. Maybe you can focus it a little, I asked. Hear me out. You said you know you have to be somewhere. What does it sound like? What does it feel like? She watched me for a moment before closing her eyes, her brow furrowing. It starts really subtle, like buzzing, bees. Sometimes sounds are echoing and strange. It's like I'm somewhere else. This is usually my sign to stop what I'm doing and find somewhere safe. If I'm out and about, I'll go into my car or pull over or stop working and go to my quiet room. Sometimes it's visions or inklings. It'll be a sudden sense of I must do this or I must be here. It'll ramp up in intensity. Sometimes it's quick. I have to go now, right this second. If it's something bigger or further away, it can be an undercurrent I don't really recognize for days or weeks. I start seeing patterns, commercials about places, ads about places. I'll hear three different people mention a concert or an event in the same day. It's pattern recognition sometimes. If I guess wrong, the buzzing increases. I get nauseous. I feel faint. If I buy a ticket, if I book the hotel or the car, the sensation lessens, but It never stops. It keeps humming along. It wants to remind me that buying the ticket isn't enough. I have to get on the plane. I have to turn the ignition in the car. When I finally get there, she trailed off for a second. Clarity. You know in those movies where the eye of the tornado is absolutely silent, or the calm before the storm? That's how it feels. It's like every noise and action and sensation that's been too loud or too uncomfortable on my skin is let up. I can take a deep breath, or for the first time in God knows how long, and then it happens. Just as I feel relaxed and elated, it all comes down. Pattern recognition, I echoed, nodding. Yes, I suppose that's it. Finding the little things that tell me where and what. So if you could focus on it more, if you could hone in on it, do you think you could get more information? I asked. She considered this, her gaze back up at the ceiling. Maybe. I don't think I've ever tried. I used to fight it. Then I went with the flow. Maybe I could narrow it down more? I shrugged. Why not? Maybe you can prevent some of it. Like, if there's a fire or something, you can pull the fire alarm before it starts? Or maybe even steer some people away from what's happening? If I could, she started, her eyes brightening for the first time since my arrival. If I could do something like that, if I could save even one person, it means so much. I've wondered why I'm like this. I'm sure you have too. Why was I given this power curse? I don't know. It seems so random and useless. What did I do in a past life or whatever to deserve to watch human suffering unload time and time again? Maybe to save a life, I offered. The ghost of a smile twitched on the edges of her lips. Do you ever see them? She asked. The faceless men? I thought back to the disasters I'd been part of Anthony's cold body in my arms. I shrugged. My own disasters I'm too invested in. I can't say that I have. I see a lot of weird shit. I try not to focus on it. Katrina barked out a laugh and nodded. Thank you. For what it's worth, I had a different idea of how this would turn out. About what meeting you would mean. I'm sorry if I misled you in my email. I didn't think you'd come otherwise. I stood to leave and shrugged. Just keep adding zeros to the offer and eventually I'll come, I said. Katrina closed the door behind me and I looked out over the street. It was empty now. The afternoon rays were harsh on the concrete and causing the ground to shift under the heat. I shuffled into my car and pulled out of the neighborhood. A lone man wearing a business suit, holding a briefcase, turned to watch as I tried not to gun it out of there. He raised his hand in a solitary wave before trotting around the corner to another street. A Conduit's Diary is created by me, written and produced by me, mixed horribly and edited by me. Cover art created by BMC Design on Fiverr. Music, intro and outro, created by Chris Hornberger.